Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. And certainly you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. You know you love it, and we love it when you do the download thing. So have at it. You can also find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, there's a lot to think about and a lot to touch on. Certainly, you've got Trump's taxes and the Mueller report and Inappropriate Joe. It's just another wacky week in the world. So to help us sort it all out and kind of make some sense of it, I have a great deal of respect for this guy. He is a warrior. He is someone who has laid down some important markers both in media and in politics. Charlie Sykes is the editor-in-chief of The Bulwark, a new effort, which, by the way, you got to check it out. It's an excellent read. You can get it daily. Host also of the Bulwark Podcast, which I've had the pleasure of doing. And a colleague of mine over at MSNBC and NBC. Charlie, welcome to the podcast, man. It's great to have you on.
It is great to be on. And I love podcasts because there are no restrictions on the words you can drop. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
We may need that today.
We very well may need that. Well, let's just get into it, man. What, you know, the thing that has really seemed to have caught folks a little bit by surprise, although I don't know if I'm that surprised by it, because I was always a little bit suspicious of what Bill Barr was doing with this Mueller report. The word out today on the street, certainly with the lead story by the New York Times, is that there's some on the Mueller team who have been telling their associates that the Attorney General kind of screwed the pooch here. He did not adequately portray exactly what their findings were with respect to the overall inquiry into Russia meddling in our elections. What's your take on this new storyline that's really kind of pushed people back a little bit on their assumptions about what the Mueller report really was or wasn't?
Yeah, well, I mean, two things. I mean, you know, part of it's surprising and part of it's not surprising. I mean, the part that's surprising is that you're getting sort of leaks from the Mueller team,
right?
You know, after 2 years of these guys never saying anything. But what's not surprising to me is that Bill Barr turns out to be an unreliable narrator. And I guess, you know, it, particularly in retrospect, the naivete of the media and the political world in thinking that Bill Barr, who auditioned for this job by writing this 19-page memo basically saying, hey, I'm going to clear the president of obstruction of justice. He becomes attorney general and he does exactly that. So there's a certain amount of like, okay, you didn't see this coming. But then there's also an interesting question, Michael. And we've gone back and forth on the Bulwark of this. Some of our writers are much more Barr friendly than I am, saying, well, he couldn't possibly have misrepresented the Mueller report because that would be irrational, right? Because he's going to be exposed. I mean, he wouldn't be so foolish.
But when is anything rational coming out of these people?
Exactly. See, this is the problem. I mean, how we are so deep into this administration, and we're still wondering about, you know, so these otherwise intelligent people allow themselves to be corrupted? Really? How's this been going on for a while now?
Right.
But yeah, this is an extraordinary moment.
You really put your finger on, I think, an important part of the pulse here, and that is, you know, we still kind of look at this administration, we look at this president, and we certainly look at some of the actors around him as if we're watching the Obama administration or the Bush administration or the Clinton administration, where, you know, there was a certain level of rationality and there was a certain level of normal behavior, expected behavior of a president, of an attorney general, and so forth. It still stuns me that people think that, I mean, particularly as you laid it out, when Barr tells you, oh, yeah, I'm going to find him, you know, not culpable, basically. I'm not going to find anything wrong here. He gets the job, and he does that, and everyone's like, well, wow, we didn't see that coming. Really? You didn't see that coming? And you don't think that, from Barr's perspective, he's already rationalized his reasoning, so even when he gets caught with his fingers in the cookie jar, He'll just basically say, well, no, that's just a misinterpretation. I mean, that's not what the report says. And I think that's why you now find some of the attorneys and others who've been involved in this thing for the last 2 years going, no, you're not going to screw our work that way. You're not going to get out here and define the space before the public really gets to see what we think the truth is.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as you know, the person that sets the narrative first often, you know, sets the narrative.
Yep.
And you can certainly understand the frustration of the Mueller folks. I mean, I think among the revelations that we're getting now, and I think it's in the Washington Post this morning, that the Mueller folks had actually prepared summaries, you know, summaries ready to be released. And they apparently were expecting that was what Mueller, I mean, that Barr was going to do. So this continually looks worse. I guess also, you know, the naivete of the media in buying this spin, there's no one who's watched this administration who believes that anybody in the Trump administration should be taken at face value, right? I mean, this is an administration that lies and fudges all the time. And yet, for some reason, either because they were shocked by the way it came out or by the brazenness of the spin, you go back and you look at those headlines and the way in which Barr successfully, with that four-page truncated memo that quotes, what, about 100 words from the Mueller investigation.
That's it, yeah.
How he, you know, he basically said this, there's nothing to see. It's a Russia hoax, complete exoneration. And now I think we're starting to see how incredibly misleading that was. But also, I think the tell is watching people like Devin Nunes and others of the Trump sycophants,
right,
who are now attacking the Mueller report and suggesting that it not be made public. Look, Michael, if this is this complete exoneration, if this is good news, and these people have been spiking the football for the last 2 weeks, if this is fantastic, why have they suddenly decided that, hey, they don't want to release this report?
Because they know it isn't. Because they thought they could get away with what Barr did, and that would be sufficient. And now that the leak is coming out from the main source that has never leaked, so the moment they leak, you know it's credible. You know you've triggered something with the Mueller team. That now's got everybody's interest going, like that Scooby-Doo moment. You know, everybody's kind of going, what's up? And so now everybody's like, well, we don't need to see this. We don't need to see the whole thing. Yeah, we do. We need to see all 400 pages of it and digest for ourselves exactly what happened. Because part of what I think, Charlie, because I was a little bit, you know, annoyed with the way the Mueller probe ended. It was really one of the most anticlimactic moments, I think, in recent probes. But I got it and I understood it. And what I think, and I'd be curious what you think about this. I my suspicion is, there's this 400-page report, but we still don't know the stuff that they sent off to the SDNY and to Washington, D.C. In other words, there's probably some aspects of this probe that they've already sort of pushed off and not really felt that they wanted to deal with because of the politics, and put that in the lap of, for example, the Southern District of New York, and that will be revealed later.
Well, it not only makes sense, and you're actually not speculating. We do know that they, in fact, spun some of this investigation off, and that there are robust grand juries going on. So this is by no means over. And also, look, the reality is, and this is one of those moments where you need to step back and remind yourself that the Mueller investigation had a specific job of determining whether certain criminal statutes were violated. And their standard would be, we're not going to bring a charge unless it's a slam dunk beyond a reasonable doubt. There are all sorts of behaviors and actions that a president can take that are fundamentally corrupt and unethical that may not rise to the level of an indictable offense. Right. So I do think that's why you need to see this report. Congress needs to make its judgment. The public needs to make a judgment. There are still so many questions that we do not have answers for about the president and about his business dealings and about why he feels the need to fawn on Vladimir Putin and why so many people lied about all of those contacts. So, but it is interesting, and I'm sure you watch this, watching people on the right, the Trumpist right, their enthusiastic celebration when this Barr memo came out, this angry dunking. And I think that there's now this sense that, whoa, that was grossly premature.
Yeah.
But I do think the fact these reports now come out are going to put tremendous pressure on the administration to release this. And when you say release, I mean, I think release the whole thing.
Oh, I do too.
It's true that you cannot legally release the grand jury information unless you get a court order to do so.
Right.
And Bill Barr could have, that Monday after the report was released, gone into court and say, I would like to get permission to release this, just like Leon Jaworski got permission to release it, just like Ken Starr got permission to release it. We need to see the whole thing.
I think you're absolutely right there, and because there's always going to be otherwise suspicions about those redacted pages and exactly what information was kind of left on the table, if you will. And I think people deserve to know exactly what level of involvement our sitting president had with respect to Russian oligarchs or anything else. I just think, for the purpose of clarity and explanation. And you would think that, to your point, if the, you know, the breastbeaters on behalf of the president are so damn secure in the notion that there's nothing here, there's no collusion, et cetera, that they would be the first ones chomping at the bit on this, because it, you know, how better to prove, you know, my guy was right, you were wrong, and now you've got a big cudgel to take with you into the 2020 campaign. But the problem is that cudgel may have some real deep spikes on the other end of it that you may get stuck with. And that's the reality, is that there's more to this than we know, and therefore we should see the whole thing. So that leads me to, you know, the Barr story coming out as it is. I couldn't help but laugh when I got off the plane and you know, looking at the news, and then here we have House Democrats now positioning themselves to go tax hunting, and their efforts to get 6 years of President Trump's tax returns from the IRS, and you know, where do you see that storyline going? You know, this committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, can't get this information. This is not they've got to go and really, you know, hope a court gives it to them, or pray that Donald Trump's accountants give it to them. If they want it, they have the procedures inside the committee to get that. And what does that mean for Trump at this point?
Well, I mean, this is, I don't want to get ahead of our skis again like we did on another investigation.
Right.
But look, there's a reason why Donald Trump has fought so vigorously not to release all these documents. What I thought was interesting was that the letter did not just go for Donald Trump's personal income tax reform returns, but also a lot of the underlying documents and a lot of the other shell companies that he's been using to trace the sources of his income. And I do think that these are legitimate oversight questions to figure out what is the source of the president's income, what conflicts might be there. It's going to be, it could potentially be, you know, quite extraordinarily revealing. And the tell, again, is the fact that the president was willing to spend a great deal of political capital in keeping these secret. Yeah. And by the way, just so your listeners understand, I mean, this is black letter law, and this goes back to the Teapot Dome scandal back in the 1920s, where it's specifically written into law that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee can ask for anybody's tax return, and the IRS shall give it to them.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you, I had no idea that this power existed, but I'm guessing the Trump administration will try to resist it, and I'm guessing that they will lose.
Well, the president comes out and he says, quote, I guess when you have a name, you're audited. But until such time as I'm not under audit, I would not be inclined to do that, meaning hand over his tax returns. This is the longest-ass audit in the history of audits. I mean, I mean, I know the IRS does audits, but damn, I mean, this audit's been going on for what, 6 years? It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even know whether they're, you know, that is true. But also the suggestion there is that it's up to him. It's not up to him anymore.
It's not.
This is now between the IRS and Congress to be able to determine all of this. I think it will be interesting to know, you know, were there routine audits? And is there any reason why you would not release a 5 or 6 year old tax return? You know, even with the existence of an audit, I mean, that's always been a bullshit explanation,
right?
But I think it's about to be exposed.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And that's the critical piece. I mean, they're not asking for, oh, give us the tax returns from 2016, because presumably that was the one that's under audit. But we want to go back 6 years. So, you know, their IRS isn't auditing, you know, 2010, 2012.
Yeah.
And I be honest with you, I don't believe there is an audit. I there may have been an audit. I don't believe that there's a currently ongoing audit, because if nothing else, the IRS probably wanted to clean that stuff up before this man became president of the United States. And they damn sure didn't want to be engaged in an audit of the president of the United States while he's president of the United States. So I just do not subscribe to this view that's proffered by the president that, you know, I'm under audit and I'm just going to wait till the audit is done. That, if you were, sir, that audit was over probably before you took the oath of office. Trust me, the IRS is not going to be dicking around in the president's tax returns while he's sitting in the Oval Office. It just, that makes no sense.
Yeah, and where this is going, I don't know. I mean, it's obviously these are kind of the crown jewels. But, you know, one thing that we've seen, Michael, is that nothing moves the president's numbers. So if it turns out that he's not as rich as he said, will that change anything? No. If it turns out he's getting lots of money from Russia, well, that would be interesting if that's what turns out to be. I think, and actually I think it was Ryan Lizza who was on CNN last night, who made an interesting point. When I first heard it, I kind of shook my head. The more I thought about it, his point was, look, this is a guy who lies about everything, cheats at golf. What are the odds that he's not cheated on his taxes? and actually, the more I thought about that, I thought, you know what? I mean, if you have somebody who is globally dishonest in every transaction in his life,
right?
What are the odds that when it comes to paying his taxes, that Donald Trump is as pure as the driven snow?
But, you know, look, if folks out there, if you are a golfer or you know a golfer and hang out with golfers, the one thing people will tell you who golf is, you can tell a lot about a person when it comes to how they play the game. And if they cheat at the game, they're more than likely cheating at everything else in their life.
Right, right.
And so, I mean, golfers have a very strict code in that regard. So it makes sense to me that since we know he cheats at golf, yeah, I suspect this whole tax thing is a little bit bogus. And it's bogus because it's hiding the crap that he's been cheating on for the last how many years. So how does this, I guess when I kind of look at, you know, I look at these two pillars, and there's so many other pillars that you and I've talked about before on air and on your podcast. How does this now begin to shape the contours of the upcoming presidential election on the Republican side? So my quick takeaway is the Mueller probe coming out the way it did, and let's just go with the Barr 4-pager mm-hmm. right now until there is a greater revelation, which you and I both believe there probably will be when the whole thing's released. That, I think, has frozen the idea of a primary challenge to Trump.
Yeah.
Because I think, certainly for Governor Hogan, the idea was, well, you know, the Barr report would be, not Barr report, the Mueller report would be a big shoe to drop. And likely if it dropped and you know, crushed a few toes, that would be the opportunity to sort of step into the space where you have a hobbled president. You don't have a hobbled president at this point. So how does the contours of this campaign get reshaped by these two pillars of the potential revelation of the Barr of the Mueller report, and now the House Ways and Means Committee more than likely getting its hands on the president's tax returns.
No, I think your analysis is right. And you know what I think is, you know, if Democrats and Republicans thought that the Mueller report was going to be the magic bullet that was going to solve the Trump problem, I think they had a wake up. There is going to be no Deus ex Mueller coming out of the sky and solving all of that. But you know, but still we're still back to this chronic, you know, long running corruption of this Trump administration. I mean, he is still Donald Trump. All of the issues that you and I have talked about the last few years are still there. If it had not been for the Russia investigation, this would still be the most corrupt administration we've ever seen.
Yeah.
It would still be the most erratic you know, offensive, you know, administration we've seen in a long time. So there's still the case for giving voters an alternative is still just as strong. I'm not disputing the analysis that it makes it less likely to have a high-profile challenger. But, you know, Donald Trump is still Donald Trump. And that's what sort of made the victory lap so sad, is that, okay, our guy is not indicted. Well, yes, but he's still a cretin. And he's still this erratic narcissist who is pursuing these policies that I think are taking the Republican Party into a long running ditch. I think you're probably right. I think the central dynamic of presidential politics now is that Donald Trump's numbers are not going to move up or down.
Right.
And the only way that he can be reelected is if the Democrats manage to nominate somebody who is even more unpopular than he is. And they seem rather determined to do, in fact, that.
Yeah, they do.
They seem to be working. They seem to be working on coming up with another candidate who, in fact, would not be able to beat Donald Trump. Because, as you and I know, for a lot of Republican voters, it's a binary choice. No matter how horrible Trump is, you know, Hillary Clinton was worse.
Absolutely.
Well, they're going to feel that way about Bernie Sanders. Trust me.
Yeah, no, I think you've put it spot on. And it still amazes me how they seem to be fascinated with their own self-immolation. They sit there, they pour the gasoline on themselves, and they sit there with the lighter, and they go, I wonder what will happen if I flick this. You know, it's like, you will blow.
Yes.
You will blow up. And it's like, it's so out of touch with where the country is. I mean, you know, you and I just spent some time in a room with a cross-section of folks, many liberals, progressive types. And again, sometimes I would listen, I would go, dude, that's just not the reality. There's a place called the middle of the country that you're not speaking to, and this you can't. Your leadoff pitch cannot be, you know, global warming when people are worried about jobs, or it can't be things that are unconnected to what's going on in people's lives right now. And Trump still speaks to that in some really kind of warped way.
No, he does, and it is remarkable. But of course, you know, you and I both have had experience of having the Republican Party ignore our good advice,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
So we're sort of used to this. But it is interesting watching, you know, people on the left who, in a lot of ways, are behaving like the right behaved a few years ago,
yeah,
which is to use their own, you know, anger as somehow a justification for taking positions that are, you know, not constructive. It is amazing to me, and I've said this on MSNBC. You have this entire freshman class of basically center left,
yeah,
pragmatic freshmen. You have more than 60 freshman Democrats, and yet you would think there's only three. And instead of talking about the people who won these swing elections, people like Connor Lamb,
yep,
and Abigail Spanberger, who you know, really gave the Democrats control of the House. Instead of talking about those folks that won elections in these swing districts, we're talking about AOC.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, Ilhan Omar. We're talking about the most extreme, in many ways, ideologically distasteful candidates. And if you actually had a laboratory coming up with, how could we come up with a scenario for Democrats to not beat Donald Trump? It's like they're they're testing it right now. They're working on it.
They really are. I just wrote a piece which I hope goes up soon. About the whole AOC GOP dynamic and how in one sense the Democrats sort of falling in line behind the Green New Deal and all of that. I mean, just kind of this rush into that madness without really thinking it through, and then of course the GOP sort of creating a political martyr, if you will, in AOC by, you know, going after her dancing and all,
yes,
know, sort of the personal traits. The voters will get to a point, and they will get there very quickly, Charlie, as you know, in which they go, you know what, I've already decided what I'm doing in the 2020 election, so I'm going to the beach. And Donald Trump will walk back into that Oval Office without missing a beat.
Yeah, you look at this, and this is frustrating to me, because you look at the map, and you know where the election is going to be decided, right? It's
yep.
going to be decided in Pennsylvania,
yep.
Michigan,
Wisconsin. Yep.
Okay, think of those. So those are blue-collar, rural states, and what we're going to run on policies that will basically, dramatically raise the cost of energy. Mm-hmm. You'll run on gun control policies. And by the way, I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, but there's a reason why Democrats did not talk about gun control for a decade or more, because they understood how that played in Ohio,
right.
Michigan, Wisconsin, all of those places. So I'm not sure that the AOC approach is really designed to win in those swing states.
And that brings me to Uncle Joe, or as he's becoming more and more known,
yeah,
as Inappropriate Joe. And I feel for Biden in some respects, because he is, and you see in his particular situation where he has been, it's not even accused of doing anything, and we've got to be very clear about that he's not being accused of any sexual harassment or any type of, you know, perverted behavior towards women. But, you know, it's how he is, you know, how he hugs people and shakes their hands and rubs their shoulders and stuff like that. And Lucy Flores, a former Nevada assemblywoman, who said Biden kissed her on the head during a campaign event in 2014, has now come forward to say it's made her feel uncomfortable and it was unwanted contact. And since her coming out, another, I think, six women have expressed their sort of uneasiness with the way Joe, greeted them. And to his credit, the vice president has now posted a video in which he pledges to be, quote, more mindful of people's personal space and much more sensitive. And it really kind of reflects, Charlie, that generational difference for a guy who's been doing this since he was 29 years old. And I think for Joe, it's an interesting aspect, because having worked for a time with, you know, people in very difficult grieving situations, after the loss of his wife and his son, I think that became a greater
yeah.
affection for him. That's how he kind of deals with and compensates. That sort of touching of life and assuming human contact was important to him, and people responded to that. And look, I'm not going to cast any aspersions on Ms. Flores, because I can't speak to what made her feel uncomfortable 5 years ago. And she now feels that this was the moment in which she wants to talk about that publicly. But I think we also have to look at the totality of this and understand in context that, you know, he wasn't being lecherous and offensive.
No.
Just as many women, if not more, have now come out to say, look, my encounters with Joe were like, you know, with my dad or with my grandfather, or, you know, he approached me at a time when I was not doing so well, and he made me feel better. So how does this play out for Joe? I still think, just on the record, I still think he is their ace card. Of all the candidates running, he is probably the kryptonite to Donald Trump's Superman. But what do you think?
I, I tend to agree. On the other hand, you know, there's he's still Joe Biden, and you know, yeah, he's
there is that.
The past, and,
there is that,
and he's like, what, he's 76 years old, which just seems to be a little bit off message. But you know, the more I think about this, but by the way, I want to make it clear that you know, I'm not a touchy feely guy. I'm not.
I'm
like the master of it. I know you are, but it's like I'm not that way. I'm the master of the awkward hug, like, you know, stiff thing, you know. But you know, and I don't want to be the guy defending Joe Biden here. But Kate, can we just take a deep breath here? That, you know, Me Too was about the abuse of power. It was about sexual assault. It was about sexual harassment. The way you've described it is exactly right. It's somebody who is being affectionate and supportive. And we're now talking about invading your personal space. Okay, excuse me. Right. We've all had close talkers. We've all had people who invade the personal space. This has never been a fundamental act of misconduct before. Invading personal space is not sexual assault. It is not sexual harassment. And the fact is that the worst thing that he's being accused of is he kisses the back of a woman's head and he rubs his nose against another woman. These are not in the category of Harvey Weinstein. These are not pussy grabbing moments. These are not, you know, getting women in a room, you know, with a, you know, lock of the door, you know, on a button. There's a category shift that is like, okay, how did we get from this real abusive behavior to a guy who may do things that are quote unquote inappropriate? And by the way, inappropriate is like a parking ticket compared to the felonies that we've been talking about. So there is this, and the fact that the, you know, some of the I'm sorry, you're not supposed to do this, but the allegations are coming forward from people who have clear political agendas and clearly are ideologically motivated. And so when I watched Biden yesterday, you know, and then, by the way, I've made fun of him as creepy Uncle Joe before. We've all seen these pictures for years. There's nothing new about this stuff at all.
But here's the thing. Can I real quick?
Never took them seriously.
Right.
You know?
And I think the thing about that, you say we've all seen the pictures of creepy Uncle Joe, right? Just kind of laughing it off. What does that tell you? We've seen the pictures, which means he's doing this publicly. This is not a guy who's got someone, you know, locked in a corner, out of sight and out of view. I mean, he's, you know, we have photographs of his engagement with people, and I don't understand why suddenly now that's like, oh my God, that's the most god-awful thing I've ever seen. I was like, no, Harvey Weinstein is the most god-awful thing we've ever seen, because that was done in the privacy of an office where he threatened women with their, you know, with their careers and so forth. Joe Biden is for Lucy Flores, this was at an event he was doing for her.
In the green room, with
all of her staff and supporters around her. This was not something that he had her in a closet. So I just
it's not a power move. Now I understand that people might feel uncomfortable about all of that, but again, this is like, you know, the difference between don't stand so close to me versus, you know, why are you putting your hand on my breast? I mean, they're not the same thing at all. You know what I'm saying?
I do. And again, to be clear, it's not to diminish for those women who now feel that was something, or even then felt that was something, but felt they couldn't say something about it. I totally appreciate that. But I'm just saying, in the broader world where all the third parties out there on Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere now deem themselves to sit in judgment of this behavior, just be careful, because trust me, when you get off your Twitter feed and you go out and you meet someone and you give them a hug, just remember, don't stand too close.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So I got one more good one for you here, then I'm going to let you scoot out of here. So yesterday was a very interesting moment in the United States Congress. And when you had the Secretary General, NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, and he came into the well of the Congress and received over 18 standing ovations on a bipartisan basis, when he made the case to Congress for the survival of NATO, the transatlantic alliance, seemingly as a rebuke, maybe a strong word, but I'll use it, towards President Trump and his attack of NATO. How did that play for you? I loved his words. I thought he posited the perfect response to what we have seen. He said at one point, we have to be frank. Questions are being asked on both sides of the Atlantic about the strength of NATO, and that has ramifications. It has real ramifications. And how do you read that sort of NATO moment, NATO responds to Trump moment, if you will?
No, I agree. I had the same take, and actually it was one of those rare moments of optimism that I had lately, watching the Congress, unified in that particular way on a fundamental principle of foreign policy. And, you know, whether you want to read it as a rebuke of Donald Trump, which I think is completely legitimate, or just a recommitment that we are still the United States of America and that we will stand by our allies, that was a good moment. And we haven't had many of those really good moments. So that was very welcome.
Yeah, it was. And I think the response by a lot of the Republicans was also welcome.
Yep.
And so hopefully, now, you know, of course, at the end of the day, you know, it's all going to rely on the next tweet and how people respond to that. But I thought, as a definitional moment in the relationship between the United States and its NATO alliance, that the Secretary General really kind of laid down the marker appropriately. And I hope the members of Congress, irrespective of the president's desires on this front, appreciate that to the point where they see the continued relevancy of having NATO in place and being a part of that. NATO can step up and, you know, put a little bit more on the table, and they agreed and they acknowledge that. But I don't think that is enough to sort of take down the alliance as a whole. So hopefully it'll be a good thing. So before we go, what are you guys working on at the Bulwark? What should we be following? And, you know, folks, please check it out for sure, because it's get it every morning when it comes out. It's an excellent. You can find it at thebulwark.com. So what are you guys working on right now, Charlie?
Well, we're trying to maintain a little oasis of rationality on on the right. We're going to be following the Mueller report. One of the things that we do is we do hold other people on the right accountable. You know, some of the strange grifters and trolls that are out there. But also, we're watching the Democrats to see whether or not they're going to be losing their minds as well. We have a really interesting piece by Jonathan Last up this morning, with the power ranking for the Democrats, how the Democrats are shaping up, and basically saying right now Bernie Sanders is the front runner. So this is real.
Yeah.
So we're trying to have a lot of fun. We're trying to be fact based. We're trying to be rational. We are one of the very, very few outlets, as you know, on the right that continues to be Trump skeptical, and that's not going to change.
No, and that's a good thing. And the fact of the matter is, it's smart, pragmatic, intelligent writing, and I really highly recommend it. You know, add it to your arsenal of information that you get every day, folks, because you will be enlightened and informed. And you'll begin to see, I think, a lot of this with the kind of clarity that often gets lost in the fog of Washington and the partisan nature of where our politics is right now, where big ideas get killed before they're even discussed. So Charlie Sykes, hell of a guy, real honor having you on the podcast, man. I really do appreciate you stopping by.
Hey, Michael Steele, thank you so much.
All right, folks, that does it for this week. But you know I'm going to come back with more, because I love you, you love me. We got a relationship. It's a thing. You know how that's how we work. But before I go, I just want to raise one little thing with you. You know, it happens to most of us at some point or another. debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is. How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, how can we make this much and still have so much debt? Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finance. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. And now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save. And take control of your finances with a loan from BestEgg.com. Visit BestEgg.com/plan. That's BestEgg.com/plan. So, but stay tuned for more from the Michael Steele podcast. And certainly don't forget to download us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever, as I like to say, you get your podcasts on. And check me out on Twitter, @MichaelSteele. Till next time, folks. Peace out.